a great storm.
About 2 years after Jesus' baptism, and it was a day where Jesus had a full day of instructing a great multitude, that after, at the end of the day, Jesus sent the multitude away, and he told his disciples to enter into a boat with him and for them to go and pass across the Sea of Galilee to get to the other side. And you recall this account, how as they were crossing the Sea of Galilee, Jesus fell asleep in the boat. And after a period of time, suddenly there was a very powerful storm and wind that arose as they were in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. And they were in danger of capsizing and drowning. And the disciples cried out to Jesus. And Jesus awoke and he rose up, and you recall how Jesus rebuked the wind and the waves and how it suddenly became completely calm. This event's recorded in three different accounts in the Bible, in the books of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And in each account, we're given some unique details of this event. An excellent commentary on this experience is found in reprint 3324. And we're going to mention, as we go along, some of the thoughts from that article. Also, in the book Discourses of Brother C. Clemion, and I noticed there's a couple copies on the book table here. He had a talk entitled Peace Be Still. And there were some wonderful lessons on this experience of Jesus and the disciples. We'd like to consider some points as we go through this review. At times during Jesus' first advent, the scriptures record that he was exhausted. And we want to consider, what is the significance of this? Secondly, was someone trying to destroy Jesus and the disciples when they were in the boat on the Sea of Galilee? Thirdly, in each of the gospel accounts, different expressions are recorded for the words spoken by the disciples to Jesus when the storm came upon them. Why? And fourthly, can this experience of Jesus and the apostles in the boat on the Sea of Galilee, can it be compared to the experiences of the church during the gospel age and also the experiences of mankind that they will have at the end of the gospel age? We're told in Luke 7, verses 1 to 10, that on this same day when this experience occurred, earlier in the day, that Jesus was in Capernaum. And as many of you know, Capernaum was located on the northwest shores of the Sea of Galilee. And there, in Capernaum, there was a centurion who sent some elders of the Jews to Jesus to ask Jesus to come and heal the centurion's servant. Because the centurion's servant, you recall, was very sick and about to die. And it was a servant that was very dear to the centurion. The word centurion meant a Roman army officer who was in charge of 100 soldiers. And that's an easy way for us to remember what a centurion is, because it's similar to our English word century, which of course means like for 100 years. So centurions had to be very experienced and valuable individuals in the Roman army to be in charge of such a large group of soldiers. And in general, the centurions and the Roman soldiers were not known for being particularly kind to their slaves. But in this account, in Luke the 7th chapter, it was different with this centurion, because it says in Luke 7, 4 to 5, the Jewish elders told Jesus that this centurion, he was worthy of Jesus to grant this desire of him to have him heal his servant who was about to die, because the centurion loved the Jewish nation, and he had built them a synagogue, which is very unusual. But you know, the Bible records several other centurions. You recall how in Luke 23:47, when Jesus died on the cross and there was a great earthquake, it was a centurion who glorified God and said, "Certainly this was a righteous man." And in Acts 10:1, you recall how Cornelius became the first Gentile to follow Christ. And he was a centurion. Also, during the Apostle Paul's life, various centurions came to his aid. And that's found in the book of Acts, chapters 21, 22, 23, and 27. So Jesus said in reply to this centurion that he would come and heal his servant. But you recall the centurion said to Jesus, "Lord, I'm not worthy that you should even come into my house, but just speak the word and my servant will be healed." And Jesus replied, and it's found in Matthew, the 8th chapter, verse 10 and 13. He said to the centurion and to those that were following Jesus, "I have not found so great faith, no, not in all of Israel." And he said to the centurion, "Go thy way, and as you have believed, so be it done unto thee." And we find that his servant was healed that same hour. Jesus' disciples who were there must have wondered whether they would develop such a faith as the centurion had. And we may wonder for ourselves if we will develop such a faith. We'd like to ask the brethren, we have a little handout that we'd like to have passed out at this time. And we're going to go through this account in step by step. And when you get the handout, there's one side that kind of looks like a table with four columns. And we're going to start with that side of the handout. And what we've tried to do is there's the three gospel accounts. The first column is the account in Matthew. The second column is the account in Mark. And the third column is the account in the book of Luke. And we have some comments on the right-hand side as we go along. We thought that would be kind of a nice way to consider some of the differences, the different details that each of the counts brings out. And we're going to start at the top. And at the top of the graph, our chart, is the account where it begins. And it begins with Mark, the 4th chapter, verses 35 to 41. And in Mark 4:35, it says there, "And when even was come, Jesus said to the disciples, 'Let us pass over to the other side.'" And earlier in the book of Mark, specifically it's found in Mark 1:32, we're told, we have the expression, "at even when the sun did set." And so we have the connection that this word "even" was right around the setting of the sun. So we can picture how at the beginning of this experience, the sun had gone down and set, and so it was going to be dark. And Jesus said to his disciples to pass unto the other side. And Mark 5:1 tells us that the other side was the country of the Gadarenes, located on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. If we go down to the second row, verse 36, "They had sent the multitudes away, and they took Jesus even as he was in the ship, and there were other little ships." And so we see there was more than one boat here on the Sea of Galilee. And so it's possible that perhaps not all 12 were in the same boat. If it mentions there were several boats, perhaps there may have been one or two boats that were right alongside as they crossed. In the third row of the chart, Mark 4:38, Jesus went to the back of the boat and he fell asleep on a pillow. And we see that at times Jesus, during his first advent, was physically exhausted from doing God's will. And we have a proof from this that Jesus was perfect and he had the human nature. because he required sleep, and he was not a spirit being. And then we find in the next row down, Luke 8:23, there came down a storm of wind on the lake. And the Sea of Galilee, the size is about 7 miles wide by 13 miles long. And to maybe perhaps give some of the brethren a comparison, down here in Florida, from what I understand, I think it's the second largest lake in Florida is Lake George, which is just up the road from here. And from what I understand, I think it's about 6 miles by 11 miles. So the Sea of Galilee would be, if you've ever been to Lake George here in Florida, it would be a little bigger than Lake George. So a fairly large lake. And the Sea of Galilee actually is below sea level. It's hard to imagine having a lake, but it's 700 feet below sea level. And there are mountains off to the east. And it actually has a tropical climate. Probably not unlike Florida a little bit, though perhaps it's not as humid as here. But there are palm trees and fruit trees for those that have had the opportunity to visit there. And so being so low in elevation, below sea level, it can get rather warm around the lake. And with the mountains being a higher elevation would have cool air. And when, depending on the air, the movements of the air, as you know from the Weather Channel and from the news, when the hot air mass and the cold mass comes together, a storm can arise. And we find in the next row down, both in really all three accounts, it talks about the ship being covered with waves and the waves beating into the ship. And Luke 8:22 says, they were filled with water and were in jeopardy. Reprint 4577 mentions the thought that it was such a violent storm that even though many of the disciples were fishermen and very experienced with being out on the lake, they were quite alarmed at this size of storm. And because probably they knew that a boat that was filling up with water and starting to sink rarely pops up and stays afloat. And of course, it was dark, and they were in the middle of the lake. And we find in the Matthew account, one of the disciples cried out, Lord, and it's Strong's 2962, a very respectful expression, supreme in authority, save us, we perish. In the Mark account, the expression was Master, Strong's 1320, which meant like a teacher or instructor, carest thou not that we perish? And in the Luke account, it was Master, Master, yet a third different Greek word, 1988, an appointee over them. So we have three different expressions crying out to Jesus. Jesus arose and he rebuked the wind, and in Matthew 4:39, he said unto the sea, peace be still. And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. And this expression, peace be still, comes from Strong's 4623, which meant silence, involuntary stillness. And the sea suddenly became still, and the waves and the wind. And Jesus said to his disciples in Matthew 8:26, why are ye fearful, O ye of little faith? Or as it says in the Mark account, Mark 4:40, why are you so fearful? How is it that you have no faith? Or in Luke 8:25, where is your faith? And we're told in Mark 4:41, they feared exceedingly and said to one another, what manner of man is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? And of course it was one thing for the winds from a powerful storm to suddenly stop. But the real miracle, as you recall, was really how the waves completely became still at once. And that showed tremendous power, because normally the waves would keep bouncing up and down, and that energy would take time normally to naturally dissipate. So one lesson we can draw from this experience was how at the first Advent, Jesus was found at times to be physically exhausted. And so we have a proof that he had the human nature and was not a spirit being. Because we have not found in the Bible any record of a spirit being needing to go to sleep and to have rest. A second lesson suggested in reprint 33:24 that it was the adversary, Satan, who was trying to destroy Jesus and the disciples in that boat on the Sea of Galilee. And it mentions three reasons in that article. The first reason is that scripturally, Satan's defined or described as the prince of the power of the air, Ephesians 2:2, and that would include the wind. Secondly, it was brought out that it was Satan who was allowed to cause a strong storm to arise and destroy the home where Job's family was together, killing them all. Job 1:18-19. So Satan had done this before, previously. And thirdly, it was because Jesus rebuked the wind and the storm. If the storm had come from God, Jesus would not have rebuked it. In each gospel account, a different expression is recorded for the words spoken, cried out by the disciples to Jesus when the storm came upon them and they were in danger of drowning. And this would suggest that there were different individuals crying out these expressions to Jesus. In the Matthew account, that individual cried out, "Lord, as supreme in authority," a very respectful title, "save us, we perish." However, in the Mark account, the expression was different, "Master," or "Instructor, carest thou not that we perish?" And in the Luke account, it was, "Master, Master, we perish." We have recorded the miraculous power Jesus had at the first advent, but we know, as it says in Matthew 28:18, how much power was given to him after his resurrection, where he said, "All power is given unto me in heaven and in earth." What did Jesus mean when he said in the Matthew account to the one disciple, "O ye of little faith"? This expression, "O ye of little faith," Jesus used several times as he was teaching his disciples. In Matthew, the 6th chapter, verses 30-33, Jesus said, "Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is, and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith?" As was mentioned at the beginning of the convention, he continues on, and Jesus said the lesson was, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." Another occasion on when Jesus used this expression, "O ye of little faith," is found in Matthew 14:29-31, where Peter was in the ship or boat on the Sea of Galilee, and he came out of the boat, as some of the brethren mentioned in fellowship today. He was the only one that came out of the boat, actually, to approach Jesus. And you recall, as Peter started to walk on the water, he started to look down and see the water and the waves, and he started to sink. And he cried out to Jesus, saying, "Lord, save me." In Matthew 14:31, Jesus stretched forth his hand, and he caught Peter and brought him to him. And he said to Peter, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" When Jesus used the expression, "O ye of little faith," was it simply a rebuke? Or was he encouraging his followers? The important word in Jesus' expression was the word "little." He did not say, "O ye with no faith," at least in the Matthew account, with regard to the storm or with Peter. Jesus recognized that his followers, like Peter, who came out of the boat to approach him, had some faith, a little faith. And so Jesus was encouraging his disciples to develop their faith. And you recall how, from our studies, particularly in Hebrews, the 11th chapter, how faith is believing what God has promised. That's really what faith, if we boil it down to its elementary elements. Whereas just a hope not based on a promise is what we would sometimes say today, wishful thinking. To have a hope but no promise is wishful thinking because there's no foundation. Whereas faith has a promise that's a foundation. This experience of Jesus and the apostles in the boat on the Sea of Galilee, can it be compared to the experiences of the church during the gospel age? We think yes. At times, each of us may have a situation that may look quite difficult, and we may feel a little bit like that, like feeling like you're in a sinking boat. It could be a number of things. It could be the death of a close loved one, maybe a spouse or a family member or a dear friend, someone in our ecclesia. It could be financial difficulty. It could be discouragement. It could be a serious illness. It could be many of those things. In our hour of need, how will we call upon the Lord? Will we address him as our teacher or as a master and our Lord and head who's in control? What will we say or ask to him? We know some of the disciples in the boat said, really, we would say, don't you see or care that we're in trouble? Or will we say, save us if it be your will? When we have the storms of life suddenly come up in our lives, how much fear will we have and how much faith will we have? Faith in God's promises destroys fear. Faith in God's promises destroys fear. And so we realize the importance of increasing our faith. It involves, as we know and have heard at this convention, taking time to personally study and read and meditate and contemplate the promises of God given to us in the Bible. And to be with the brethren in the studies and in the conventions and in the fellowship to encourage one another. So when the storms of life suddenly rise upon us, we will be better able to remember the promises of God. Promises such as Psalms 46, verses 1 and 2. Psalms 46, 1 and 2, where it says, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Or Isaiah 26, verse 3 and 4, thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is stayed on thee, because he trusteth in the Lord. And that we should trust in the Lord forever, because in the Lord is everlasting strength. At the beginning of the hour, we sang the words to hymn 328, He Will Hide Me. These were words written by Mary Servos, and she lived during the 19th century. If you turn your sheet over on the other side, you can see when she was, where and when she was born and died. And she had a very challenging personal life. She lived with her crippled grandmother for 18 years and later took care of her parents until they died. She wrote the words to not only He Will Hide Me, but also the hymn that I believe we opened up the convention with today, Be Glad in the Lord and Rejoice. There was someone who inspired Mary to write gospel songs, and that was mentioned also in the first discourse of the convention, Fanny Crosby. And you can see the years and places where she was born and where she died. And perhaps many of you know, I didn't realize this until looking in a little deeper, that Fanny Crosby was really a prolific writer of the words of hymns in history. And would you believe she was blind really her entire life? From the age of 6 weeks old, she was blind. And it says that she wrote the words to over 8,000 hymns. That's not a typo. That's what they indicate is 8,000 hymns. And it's interesting it was recorded when they asked her about her blindness. We'd just like to read that. She said, it seemed intended by the blessed providence of God, I should be blind all my life. And I thank him for the dispensation. And if perfect earthly sight were offered me, I would not accept it. I might not have sung hymns to the praise of God if I'd been distracted by the beautiful and interesting things about me. From what we understand, during her lifetime, she was one of the more well-known women in the United States. And most of the hymnals, at least in the U.S., contain much of the hymns she wrote. You know, today you can go on Yahoo or Google and type in things and search for information. And there was a list of 385 of these hymns that she wrote the words to. And going down through that list, we quickly found that there were 12 that we use in our hymn book, whether it's the blue or the red book. And we've listed those hymns, as you can see listed here. And so it's quite interesting when we think about that, and as we sing the hymns in our hymn book and we think about the meaning of those words, it kind of gives a little additional appreciation of to think of the writers of these words and expressions that we use in our meetings, of the storms of life that they had, which drew them closer to the Heavenly Father. The experiences of mankind at the end of this gospel age will also seem like a great raging storm coming suddenly upon them. In fact, Jesus used this picture of a great storm to illustrate this in Luke 21, verses 25 and 26. Luke 21, 25 and 26, where he says, "And upon the earth distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth." And we see this growing day by day as time marches on. It will be strange for mankind to see all the false religious systems fall down and the corrupt government systems and the corrupt systems of men be shaken and destroyed. And it's going to seem strange to see this great storm of going into chaos and anarchy. But we're told that as a result of all this, that we have the promise found in Micah, the fourth chapter, verses 1-3. Micah 4, 1-3 tells us, "But in the last days it will come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established in the top of the mountains, and it will be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations will come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks." We certainly don't see that occurring today. And what a blessed day that will be when man's energy will not be focused on war and controlling and destroying, but to uplift one another. "And nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." We'd like to close by reading, and it's found in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, verses 26-28. Hebrews 12, verse 26-28 reads, "But now he hath promised, saying, Yet once more I shake not the earth only, but also heaven." And this word, "yet once more," signifies the removing of those things that are shaken as of things that are made, man-made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. And it closes with the promise, wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. And that is our prayer for each one of us, that we may receive a kingdom which cannot be moved, and that we may have grace whereby we can serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Amen.